Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Very nice to see everybody in person. And of course, we're here to commemorate, really, Rabbi Sachs's life. A yahrzeit is a very unusual thing in Judaism. When we talk about a yahrzeit, sometimes we think of it as a sad occasion. And obviously, only one year on, there is obviously still an element of loss that we still feel, an element of sadness that is still with us. But really, in essence, a yahrzeit is supposed to be a celebration. And as time goes on, it's more and more of a celebration of life, a celebration of a legacy, and particularly with regards to Rabbi Sachs, a celebration of a legacy that we will continue, and we will obviously perpetuate in his memory for many years to come. And this evening, in that sense, is of course dedicated to his memory, Harav Yaakov Tzvi Ben David Aryeh, and our learning this evening will be in his memory. And the learning this evening will be very much based on the last time that I heard him speak in person. It was actually 2 years ago this week. I don't know, just coincidence. 2 years ago this week, he was speaking actually in memory of somebody else. But I thought that he wasn't talking about the person specifically. The ideas that he shared at the time I found very, very profound. And I thought they were something I would like to share, and I think very, very much apply to Rabbi Sachs himself. Before we get to that, I just want to mention one other thing, and also to clarify that this is a little bit interactive. If anybody does have comments, questions as we go through, please feel free to chime in and be part of the discussion. I always feel learning is important to be done in an interactive way, in a way that we can engage with each other. But just one thing I'll mention about Rabbi Sachs before we get into the details of the shir itself. As we sometimes talk about what we refer to as a gadol, somebody who is a great person. And that idea of being gadol, the word gadol literally means big, right? Literally means very large. But in Judaism, we refer to somebody great as being a gadol. And when we look at that phrase, very, very interestingly, it's attributed first and foremost to the Almighty himself. But we refer to God as being gadol. And particularly on Motzei Shabbat, we say this in our prayers, but I think you find this idea many, many times. But in V'yitten Lecha, which we say on Motzei Shabbat, we say that whenever we talk about the Gedulato Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whenever we talk about God being great, in the same sentence, we talk about how he remembers. In a sense, he doesn't forget, even though God is all-powerful, is somebody who is a being who, in a sense, knows everything that goes on in the world, can control everything going on in the world. Part of being great is not forgetting the people that everybody else forgets, in a sense. Not forgetting the individuals around, the people who might get forgotten by others. And when I think of Rabbi Sachs, in many senses, we think of a great person. We think of somebody who was a world figure, who was this immense teacher and intellectual. But in my family, we think of Rabbi Sachs as the person who called my parents when my grandparents passed away. So that's just to sort of show that sense. I think it's a very, very powerful idea that when a great person, again, is somebody who can connect to individuals, connect to people, and always there to be able to help anyone and everyone, I think that is the mark of a truly great person. And in that sense, I'll begin some of these ideas that Rabbi Sachs shared, as I said, 2 years ago. So he began by noting the fact that many have a little bit of a negative view on what we call rabbinic Judaism. Gets a little bit of a bad rep sometimes. Particularly sometimes we're bothered with the fact that there seems to be an over-focus on details. Talk about a lot about minutiae, a lot about sort of very, very dry things. You go through the Mishnah and we're talking about, very, very technical aspects, very unusual circumstances, and we're trying to sort of figure out all these odd halachot, whether they apply or they don't apply, and what exactly is going on in all of this. And in one sense, we might sort of turn away from that. And yet Chazal themselves referred to, he attributes this statement to perhaps a sort of a rebuttal of that idea. There is a statement that Chazal say where they actually refer, in a sense, comparing themselves or comparing rabbinic Judaism to the era of prophecy that came perhaps a little bit earlier, the era of the prophets, the Nevi'im, where the Gemara says, Chacham Adif Minavi. Where a wise person is greater than a prophet. Wise person is greater than a prophet. And the Gemara doesn't really offer much else on this. Doesn't really sort of clarify why that would be, what exactly that means. It does offer a proof text. It does link it to a verse. But in the usual rabbinic or the usual sort of Talmudic style, the verse doesn't really mean in its pshat form what the Gemara explains it to mean, right? It refers to the verse v'navi levav chachma, and it says v'navi, right, a prophet, in a sense levav chachma, their heart is full of wisdom, and the fact that you are attributing wisdom to a prophet must mean you attribute always the greater thing to the lesser thing, and therefore we see that wisdom is greater than prophecy. But v'navi in that verse doesn't mean a prophet. V'navi in that verse means let us bring. Navi means let us bring. Okay. An unusual sort of proof. What exactly is going on? And yet, Chazal have this statement: Chacham adif minavi, a wise person is greater than a prophet. And Rabbi Sacks offered basically three areas, and I think there are others as well, but he offered three areas in which we perhaps see this greatness shining through, or where they accomplish things that perhaps prophets were not able to do so. And the first of those is perhaps the greatest ideal that we talk about and the greatest ideal that we hope for, and that is the ideal of shalom. Okay, we'll begin with talking about peace. He mentioned an interesting, I'd never heard this before, but a professor called Michael Howard, not to be confused with the politician, has a book called The Invention of Peace and the Persistence of War. Okay, and talks about how the fact that war has existed as long as humans have existed, but peace is a modern invention, right? Peace is only in the last couple of centuries, it's a modern invention. Says Rabbi Sacks, all you have to do is look through the Nevi'im to see that that's not the case, right? Throughout the Nevi'im, throughout the prophets, we have multiple statements all about shalom. Hashem oz la'amo yitan, Hashem yivarech atamo shalom, just being perhaps the most famous one, but there are so many that we make a very, very central part of our liturgy. We talk about shalom. The Mishnayot end with shalom. Our davening ends with shalom. Our benching ends with shalom. Almost everything we do, we try to end it with this concept of shalom, of peace, something which we talked about, you know, since the beginning. And the Nevi'im, the prophets, talked about shalom, had this great, great ideal of shalom. Perhaps the one of the most famous. In fact, it's not just us who use these statements, right? Who else uses the statements of the prophets to talk about peace? Everybody. We see them all over the place. Perhaps most notably, Rabbi Sacks noted this himself. I just think it's very, very interesting that outside the United Nations building in New York, of course, is one of the most famous statements regarding peace of the prophets. The vision of Yeshayahu, of Isaiah, where he talks about we will beat our swords into plowshares, etc. And that entire verse is outside of the United Nations. Again, whether or not it's been accomplished by the United Nations or not, or will be accomplished by the United Nations or not, but it's outside, okay? So that's good. It helps with the vision, right? It helps with the vision. And again, we see that the prophets had this tremendous vision, this tremendous ability to sort of talk about peace and the importance of peace for so long. So how did the rabbis, how did the Chachamim, what we refer to as Chazal, Chachamim Zichronam Livracha, may their memory be for a blessing, how did they view peace? What did they do with peace? It's exactly what we said before. They talked about details and talked about minutiae. So let's look at a couple of different statements that Chazal refer to when they talk about peace. So the Mishnah in Gittin says that when you have a sort of a multicultural community that you live in a place with Jews and non-Jews together. It's not a shtetl like there was, or a ghetto, right? But there were some times where you actually had non-Jewish neighbors, right? Nowadays, not so uncommon. But once upon a time, maybe that was a bit unusual. And Chazal said that if you find yourself if you happen to be a community like that, so you should make sure, mefarnasin aniyei akum im aniyei Yisrael. You shouldn't just give charity to the Jewish poor around. You should give charity to everybody around. Why? In order to ensure that there's peace among everybody. And mevakrin choleakum im chole Yisrael. Again, same thing. When you're going to the hospital and you're visiting people who are unwell, don't just go and visit the Jewish people who are there. Visit everybody who's there. Mipnei darkei shalom. Again, the same thing. This is something I think we would do if it was necessary. But in a sense, we sort of do keep a separation when we have this, in circumstances where we can. But if necessary, then, or where appropriate, right? Even covering, Then we even bury, right? Even burying, again, because that is the ultimate kavod, the ultimate sort of honor that we show to a person when necessary. So again, even still, we would ensure that non-Jews who required burial would also get a burial, right? Would also get a burial, just as we ensure that Jewish people also have a burial to show that honor to the departed, to the deceased, just as we would show them to Jews. Why? Mipnei darkei shalom. Again, the importance of peace. So they took this very, very lofty ideal, in a sense, and brought it into something. Now, it's not quite as exciting, right? It's not something you'd, it's not something I would definitely print on the wall, right? And put up and say, this is our vision that we're aiming for. But it is something that happens in reality, right? It is something that happens in the world around us. And actually, there are many, many other statements like this. For instance, when we have people called up to the Torah, so what order do we call people up in? So we're all familiar with the fact that we call up Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, right? That wasn't always the case. That was instituted by Chazal. Why? Mipnei darkei shalom. Again, this same idea. Mipnei darkei shalom. They instituted that we would have Kohen, Levi, Yisrael. Why? So there are a couple of different reasons. I think the simpler reason, or perhaps the more technical reason, is that everybody wants to be the first one. Right? Everybody wants to be the first one. And once you get rid of the first, once you sort of say, okay, the first has to be, this person or this person, so then it's a bit simpler, okay? In a sense, you could still say that on a Shabbat morning, everybody wants to be third, but third is not the same as first, right? It's not really the same. Everyone knows. Yeah, you might be the third one, it's true, but once you're third, it's not, It's not quite the same. So that's a simpler idea. Rabbi Sachs actually very interestingly gave it more of a historical context, which I hadn't quite heard before, and I think requires a little more maybe looking into the details. But very interestingly, he linked it to the sort of to the split that happened around the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. That of course there were different sects within Judaism at the time. We were familiar with perhaps some of the names of the sects: the Purushim and the Sadukim, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And again, there were sort of sects. There were some of the sects, most notably the Sadukim, right, tended to be more priestly sects, tended to be more linked to the Kohuna, to the priesthood, and the Purushim, who ultimately, I wouldn't say won, but in a sense that's sort of the descendants. Chazal came more from the Purushim, from that sort of line, that sort of community. And yet they still gave honor to the Kohanim, and particularly again, where was the main honor that was given to Kohanim? Where did they have their greatness? Their greatness was obviously linked to the temple, and at a time where they'd lost that greatness, at a time where in a sense they'd lost their ability to function in the world, their sense of purpose and their sense of grandeur, Chazal came along and said, "Mipnei darkei shalom, we're going to reinstitute it, we're going to put it back in, we're going to say that actually still in our synagogues we're going to call them up first," and again, "Mipnei darkei shalom," they continue to do that. So what we see here is a very interesting thing, which is that, and we'll sort of flesh it out in a couple of different examples as well, but what Rabbi Sachs is really trying to show, I think, is that this idea of Chacham Adif Minavi, of the wise being greater than the prophet, is a recognition of the fact that while prophets have these wonderful visions, and not to minimize or not to criticize, but it's very, very lofty, and it's very idealistic, and it's, as in Rabbi Sachs's own word, it's utopian, right? It's utopian. Have we seen swords being beaten into plowshares? We haven't seen it. Are we likely to see it? We certainly hope so. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't look like it's going to happen in the next week or two, right? So again, it's wonderful ideals, but it's about, in a sense, it's about bringing it down into reality, bringing it down into circumstances which all of us encounter in our regular lives. And actually, I was particularly struck by the fact that the Mishnah, which we referenced just earlier, Mefarnesin Aniyei Akum, that we give charity to non-Jews as well as Jews, etc., and all of those Mipnei Darkei Shalom, you know, visiting the sick, Jews and non-Jews alike, is something which perhaps might be a little bit more obvious to us today, or perhaps might be something which we think, yes, okay, you know, that's not such a radical statement, but at the time was an extremely radical statement, right? Long, long predating any other multicultural society, was an extremely radical statement, extremely unusual establishment of principles that would ensure that there would be peace, that people would get on together, that there would be this sense of community that went beyond the sort of traditional borders themselves. Okay, that's area number one. Any comments, questions, thoughts? Full yarn. Yes. Could be. Again, I think that's, in my mind, following the same tradition. Very nice ideal. Not sure the BBC was necessarily the... Could be. Before my time, 1950s. Sorry.
If you ever got a tin of, I think it's treasure, Lyle's golden syrup, you'll see that on the front it's got a picture of a lion shall lie down with the lion.
Right, okay, that's another good one. That's another good one. I'll come back, actually, you remind me of a story, yes.
There's a very practical application as well of what you've been saying, and we noticed this, and World Jewish Relief make a point of doing it, that when they are looking after desperately poor Jews in Ukraine and the Soviet Union, they look after the non-Jewish poor and the people living nearby. Now, part of that is what we've been talking about, but the other part is that otherwise the non-Jews take it as an offence, that all the available money of charity and food and so on goes to the Jews,
right,
to them. So they actually employ non-Jewish carers and drivers and cooks and all the rest of it, keeping to Jewish principles.
I think exactly, beautifully. I think that's exactly the point. So in a sense, that's something which we encounter in the world, something which is real, something which we can implement, and in a sense is able to bring these ideals into life. Keith mentioned the wolf will lie down with the lamb, which is another vision of Yeshayahu. Again, another beautiful ideal of peace. Has that ever happened? So, very interesting story. Rabbi Sachs also mentioned that he heard Rabbi Lau, former chief rabbi of Israel, speak at the United Nations and quote that verse. And he talked about wolf lying down with the lamb, and he said it did happen once in history. He said once in history the wolf did lie down with the lamb. Where was that? So he said, in Noah's Ark, right? Noah's Ark, the wolf got on with the lamb. Why? Why? Because if they don't get on and one gets kicked out, then you'll just drown. And he said, and that's the mentality we have to have. He said, the only way we're actually going to manage to sort out peace is if we recognize the fact that if we don't do it, then we'll all drown. You know, that'll be the end. So very interesting perspective. But there you go. So you reminded me of that with that also verse. Okay. So that's a little bit about shalom, a little bit about peace. I wouldn't say from one extreme to another, but the second area in which Rabbi Sachs showed this concept of Chacham Adif Min Navi is almost the opposite end, but I don't think so. I think it's still very much in keeping with the concept of peace, but that is the idea of rebuke. Okay? And let's look now very briefly at the difference between a rebuke within the Nevi'im, within the prophets, and rebuke within rabbinic Judaism, within Chazal, within the Mishnayot and Gemara, etc. So, there is, of course, a mitzvah from the Torah. It's not one which we talk about a lot, but there is actually a commandment in the Torah, Hocheach Tochiach et Amitecha, right? That you should rebuke your fellow, you should feel responsible. Now, we're not going to, this doesn't mean that we should just go and sort of shout at everybody who we see doing anything wrong because that's what the Torah says, right? That's not the intention of the verse. So what is the intention of the verse? So let's come back to Chazal, how Chazal take that verse in just a little bit. But, having said that, when we look in the Nevi'im, as one example, just one example of this, God actually commands Yechezkel. Okay, now Yechezkel, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yeshayahu, these are prophets who sort of lived around the time of the end of the first temple, Okay, the end of the first temple, destruction of the first temple. And this was a time where obviously the Jews were very much not on the right path. They needed somebody to try and encourage them. And that's very much what the prophecy, we refer to them as prophecies, but some of them were about the future, but some of them were about the present. Were about Jeremiah, Ezekiel and Isaiah going out to the people and encouraging them to change their ways, to say what's going on over here is not right, and there's going to be consequences for what's going on. And, for instance, God tells Yechezkel that you should go and tell the people, go and explain to them what they're doing wrong, etc., etc. This is what they're doing, no good, they should change their ways. And he says to him, Im yishma'u, im yechdalu. Whether they listen or whether they stop listening, whether they ignore what you're saying, right? Whether they have no interest in what you're saying at all, i.e., tell them whether they're willing to listen or not. You stand up there and you shout at them, regardless of whether they're doing it. And how does the verse end? V'yad'u ki navi haya betocham. That they should at least know that there was a prophet, that they were warned, right? It's like, we've got to be careful what we say about the prophets, and maybe if we have time at the end, we'll sort of come back to defend the prophets, but at the moment we're talking about chacham adif mi navi, why in a sense there's an element of what Chazal have that is a little bit greater in a certain sense. So as I said, perhaps later we'll defend the prophets, but while we're not defending them, what this sounds a lot like is we're washing our hands of it. You know, as long as we've made the announcement, then it doesn't matter what happens, right? I don't really, it's like a little bit of, sometimes I think about some of the sort of health and safety things we have nowadays. It's not about whether we're really actually being safe at all. It just means that I've put up the sign so that you know that I warned you. I don't really care if you break your leg. I just want to know that I'm not going to be blamed afterwards, right? So it's like the same thing over here, right? Im yishmu im yechdalu. Listen to me, don't listen to me, I don't care. But just I'm just telling you, I've told you, and I'm done here. Now, thank you very, very much. Right? So it's a little bit like that. It's a very strange thing. Like I said, maybe if we have time later, we'll try and defend that. But this certainly comes back to the idea of tochacha, and that is not the sense, very much not the sense in which in which Chazal took it. Now, I suppose we'll just... it's worth explaining why this fits into Nevuah. Nevuah is about a vision, right? It comes back to what we said before. It's about ideals. It's about projecting a vision. Now, it might not end up in reality, but it was important for God, through his conduit of a Navi, of a prophet of the time, to announce to the people that these are consequences that will come if you do not change your ways. As we said, it didn't. It didn't change their ways. So how does Chazal view? So there are three statements of Chazal about, there are probably more, but three I think that are particularly relevant here that give us really parameters on both ends of what it means to have tochacha, to give rebuke. Number one is Mishnah in, I think it's a Gemara actually in Bava Metzia, where it says, Hocheach afilu mea pa'amim. Even 100 times, and 100 in Chazal means, forever, basically. You know, the point is there's no limit to this, right? Even 100 times, i.e., if the person doesn't listen, you try again, and again, and again. Now, what did Yechezkel do? Yechezkel said, I'm going to say it, and whether you listen or you don't, in a sense, I've announced it. Over here, we see that you have to go back and try again. If a person doesn't listen to you, then you try again. Not only that, the Gemara elsewhere takes it further. They say, Ad Nazifa, Ad kelala, ad haka'a. You may be cursed. You may be embarrassed. You may be hit. Right? The person may get so angry with you, and yet you still have the responsibility to try and help them. Now again, that's on one end. Okay, that's on one end. Yet we also have, and I think you have to take both together. We also have a Gemara in, I think, Bava Metzia as well. The Gemara in Yevamot says the following. It says kashem shemi, and this I find a very, very fascinating statement of Chazal. Kashem shemitzvah al adam lomar davar hanishma. Just as there is a commandment, there is a mitzvah, i.e. within this hocheach tochiach, within this commandment to rebuke people, there is a mitzvah to say something that will be heard, i.e. you know that someone will listen to you when you tell them what they need to hear. Kach mitzvah al ha'adam. So too, there is also a commandment, or there is also a value, an importance in shelo lomar davar she'eno nishma, of keeping quiet when it's something that you know it will not be heard, right? Where you know that the person, in a sense, that you'll make it worse, right? That your statement won't only fall on deaf ears, it will fall on worse than that, right? You'll, in a sense, create more of a problem for the person. And I think this idea of Torahah, when we talk about rebuke, what Chazal are trying to paint for us, a picture that one has to do this in a very, very balanced and careful way. But what I think the one word that comes through from all these various statements is that the goal of tochacha, the goal of rebuke, is not just to make a statement, but to be effective. To be effective. I.e., if you think you're going to get nowhere, then the mitzvah, the commandment, is to hold your tongue, to hold back, to not say anything. If you think you will be effective, can you just do it once? Can you say, I've done my job and I'm finished? No, you can't. Then you have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing, even where it becomes a little bit uncomfortable, even where it becomes a little bit challenging. So it's sort of that very delicate. Now, figuring out which situations to apply that to is for us to figure out. Okay, that's its own challenge. But at least the parameters over here are helpful to us. Now we sort of have a much better sense of what it means to rebuke. And I think one thing that I certainly, actually there are two things that I try to bear in mind, particularly with regards to this. The first one is I once asked Rav Nemantzel, who is actually still a great sage and lives in the old city. I used to have the honor of seeing him study and listening to him a little bit every afternoon when I studied in yeshiva in Israel. And I tried to ask him a question very regularly, actually. Someone inspired me. Someone told me that they once knew a great sage and they never asked them anything and they always felt bad about it. So once I heard that statement, I set myself a challenge that I would ask Rav Nemantzel a question every afternoon when he came in. And I'm sure he doesn't know my name. And I'm sure if he saw me, he would think, that's that annoying English fellow who used to, but anyway. So yes, I used to ask him all sorts of silly questions. But one of the questions that I asked him was the following. I said, you know, do you have to? I said, you know, if you know that somebody is perhaps not doing something right, and you think you can help them, you know, you think you can help them, do you have to? You know, what if you're struggling with that as well? You know that you yourself are not perfect, right? So maybe you shouldn't say anything until, in a sense, you've perfected yourself. And he looked at me with a smile, which he always did, and he said, then you'll never tell anyone anything. So I said, I don't know, maybe he's just referring to me. But he said, if you wait till you're perfect, then you'll never tell anyone anything. Okay, so you don't always need to be perfect. But I think the other thing we need to bear in mind as well is, and this is the most difficult one, is whether we're saying it because we're annoyed, i.e. I'm annoyed, or whether I feel it's beneficial for another person. And that I find to be the most challenging one. We always need to think about the in a sense, the person who we're talking to, rather than how annoyed we are ourselves. A lot of the time when we're annoyed about something, it's because of whatever. It's something which annoys us. So again, tochacha is a very difficult thing to put into practice. But what I think we get the sense of from here is, again, these two extremes when it comes to nevuah and chokhmah, when it comes to the Nevi'im, in one sense, and the sort of rabbinic Judaism, Chazal, on the other hand, where the Nevi'im set this beautiful ideal, as we said, this vision, right? There's something which just needs to be on the table. It is a vision, it is an ideal, and it needs to be there, but it doesn't matter whether it's listened to, or whether it's practical, or whether it's taken on board by the listener or not. And Chazal were the exact opposite. Chazal, as I said, didn't have this, or didn't phrase it in a way which makes us sit up and say, wow. But it does give us parameters which hopefully we can put into practice. Right? It gives us, yes, details. It gives us dry details, you know, boring details, minutiae, but where it sort of helps us to, as I said, to bring that into a reality, to bring that into our life, to bring that into a sort of a practical sense that we can actually have in our day-to-day, in our day-to-day living. Okay, that was area number two. Any thoughts, comments, questions before we move on?
Yes. When we were discussing before, I always wonder how we would rate today the success of Nevi'im. Right? You know, so if you think about business goals, management goals,
right,
they each have objectives, and if you had to measure them, how many people did they manage to change? And really, if you look at it, yeah, they're visionaries, but they were given tasks. They had to be measurable, quite clear tasks. They had to go and speak to people. They had to be in the square, in the public space. So I just wondered your thoughts thoughts on that?
You know? No, I think that's the point, really. I think you're making a very good point in the sense that if we're using those measurable goals, if the measure of success is how many people it affected, then you're right. It was unsuccessful. But what I think we're developing here is an idea, meaning we're not really explaining why Nevuah doesn't have to be this. Maybe if we have time, we will do. I think you find it more in the writings of Rav Kook than in what I heard personally from Rabbi Sacks. But Rabbi Sacks is, in a sense, focusing on the Chacham Adif Minavi, right? The sort of second statement of this. Why Nevuah had to be that way is maybe we'll come back to that. But you're right. The measure of success clearly is not how many people or how effective it was on the people at the time, because it wasn't, right? Because it wasn't. There seemed to be something else that the Nevi'im are providing, that ideal, that vision, which is not about how many people actually took it on, right? But with rebuke, we see it a little bit. With peace, we see it even more, right? I think even more. Again, there's beautiful visions, and none of them have come to fruition, right? That's exactly what we're saying over here. So I would like to address it at the end. So let's hold off on it. Yes.
There's another point on the chayah, especially with something like the law of the community, and that is he has to be very careful when he stands up in the pulpit and starts telling the congregation what they should or shouldn't do, and that's because of Shogay Mazer.
Well, I think that's the same thing. Yeah, it's the same. Meaning that comes back to the same idea of, you're right. So there's a concept of what we call mutav shehu shogagim, right? That sometimes it's better, in a sense, somebody does something without realizing that they're doing anything wrong. And when you tell them they're doing something wrong, they'll continue to do it, but now they're doing it brazenly, right? Whereas before they were doing it unintentionally, now because of what you've said. So in a sense, now they're doing it just for the sake of doing it, right? I mean, I have this with the kids quite a fair amount, right? Like, you know, they're sort of, I don't know, they're eating a sweet. Sometimes it's better not to sort of jump in that moment, because then they'll just sort of keep eating them while they're smiling at you and driving you mad over doing it. You just sort of pretend you haven't seen it and the world is a better place. So you're right. That, and Chazal do talk about that. And I think it comes back to the same idea. Sometimes it's better not to say something if you know that it won't be listened to. As I said before, the challenge of figuring out when that is and when that's not, I think, is the most difficult challenge. That's a very difficult one. And actually, sorry, I've just come back to that. I don't think... I mean, maybe once upon a time this was part of the goal of a rabbi, but I think hocheach tochiach is a mitzvah which applies to everybody. It's not just rabbis, not the only people who are supposed to tell everyone they're doing anything wrong. But hopefully most of the time we don't do that. It's for everybody who feels that if you feel that you can have an impact on somebody in a very specific area. I mean, I don't find this a lot, but it does happen. You know, you have a friend and you feel that you could put an arm around their shoulder and really sort of encourage them to do something a little bit differently. That's a responsibility that applies to everybody, every person who finds themselves in that particular position.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
The Nevi'im are sending messages having been inspired by Hashem in some way or another.
Right.
How do the Chazal see themselves in terms of divine inspiration in terms of their interpretation?
Right, that's a very good question. Although there's two separate things. So there's in terms of interpretation is different to other elements. So it's a very big topic, but I'll try and very, very briefly, because I think it is important to clarify for our purposes. There is an age of prophecy which certainly according to our tradition, everybody agrees ended, right? Ended, whether it's exactly, I mean, the Gemara, there is a statement in the Gemara where it says it's at the end of the Second Temple, whether it's exactly, you know, at the moment it was destroyed or maybe slightly earlier during the sort of waning of the Second Temple, you know, the end of that period. It's around that sort of time, okay? Around that sort of time was the end of the age of prophecy, as it were. And actually the Gemara says that anybody who claims to be a prophet nowadays, well, doesn't say very, let's just say it doesn't say very positive things about such a person. Okay, so in that sense, they don't view themselves as prophet. There is a concept of what we call Ruach HaKodesh, that there is a sort of a concept of a softer divine inspiration. But when we talk about interpretations, most of the time when the Talmud is talking about interpreting a verse, what they're referring to is traditions which have been handed down from Moshe. So that's long predating the age of Chazal. That's not their own interpretations in a sense. Those are traditions that they are writing down, right? The Mishnah and the Talmud Talmud was sort of the first time where these things were written down in that sense, but it wasn't the first time that they were talked about. Right? We have traditions that go, as I've said, long before then. So it's a whole trillant, for lack of a better term, of different elements, but certainly there is an end to prophecy, and they don't see themselves in that sense, but there are parts where they're sort of taking on what happened before and simply noting down what was accepted from earlier. Okay, the third area, which I think is a little bit more subtle, actually, a little bit more subtle, but Rabbi Sacks did talk about this, and I think it's worth mentioning it, and he referenced actually his own introduction to the Siddur. So you can read it for yourselves. Very good. We'll probably sort of pick out a couple of sentences, but the third area is basically prayer. Okay? When we talk about prayer, when does prayer date back to? So sometimes we think that prayer dates back to around the time of what we call the Anshei Knesset Hagadolah, the men of the Great Assembly. Certainly we talk about a sort of an establishment of prayer replacing Korbanot. And there's elements of that are true, but it's not quite as simple as that, because we also have other traditions which tell us, for instance, actually around these parashiot, we talk about the Avot, right? We talk about our forefathers praying. We talk about Avraham establishing Shachrit, right? Yitzchak Mincha, Yaakov Mariv, right? So when exactly did prayer begin? And the answer is that prayer goes right back. Prayer is about talking to God, and that goes right back to the first human beings who in a sense spoke to God, right? Prayer can be done anytime, anywhere, but you're right, formal prayer came about a little bit later on. And there's a little bit of a debate as to whether the formal prayer that we have nowadays, I just sort of gave away the two strains, but there is a little bit of a debate as to whether the prayers that we have nowadays are based on the tefillot of our forefathers, right? Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and others as well. For instance, Chana, right? We talk about Chana having a very significant influence on the prayer that we have nowadays. A little bit later than our forefathers. But certainly predating long predating the time of the Mishnah, predating the first temple, right? She was the mother of Shmuel, who was before the first king of Israel, before King Saul. So this is long before the establishment of formal prayer. And we have another tradition where we talk about prayer replacing, as we said, or sort of being instituted post-sacrifice. So which is correct? So we have a debate in the Gemara, debate in the Rishonim, right? And debate that sort of continues throughout, I wouldn't say quite continues until today. Why not? Because Chazal, says Rabbi Sacks, solved the problem. How do you solve a problem where people have a disagreement? What do? Both of them are right. Right? You just do both of them. What do? So we said, we have that. In every prayer service that we have the Amidah how many times? We say it twice. We don't just say it once, we say it twice. We say it as an individual, and we say it as a community. And in that sense, again, we sort of bring this concept of prayer, right, which was a challenge for so many, which to figure out how do we conceptualize prayer, engaging with God in this sense. We had this big debate. No one could quite figure out. Some said it was, more similar to an individual simply connecting to God. And others say, no, it's based like linked to the temple and linked to sacrifices and public worship, etc. And what do? So we do both. We do both. We have an individual prayer and we have a communal prayer that follows. We have the silent Amidah that each of us says as an individual. And then we have the repetition, which represents the communal element, which is perhaps more linked to the sacrifices. And what's the best proof of this? When is the one time that we don't have the communal prayer, the one prayer in the day, every day, when we don't have a repetition, is a Maariv, right? In the evening, why not? Because there were no sacrifices, right? Because there were no sacrifices at Maariv. So again, so we see that the communal element disappears. So again, I think in a more subtle way, okay, maybe let's find it over here. He says, let's read it from Rabbi Sacks' language himself. He says over here, what had once been two quite different forms of worship now became one. Prayer took on the highly structured character of the sacrificial service with fixed texts and times. The silence that accompanied the sacrifice once was transmuted into speech. Two traditions, prophetic prayer on the one hand and priestly sacrificial service on the other, merged and became one. So again, this same idea, right? That we have within our, as he said, prayer as we have known it for two millennia draws on both traditions. We have each Amidah is said twice, once silently by individuals, a second time aloud, and publicly by the leader. So again, Chazal seem to be sort of bringing down this concept, this difficult concept of prayer, which no one can quite figure out, and bringing it into a reality, bringing it into a world where we can make it practical, where we can make it something that we can engage with, and in a sense be something that that we can bring into the world that we inhabit. Okay, any comments, questions, thoughts, or we'll wrap up and maybe, okay, we'll give a little bit of time to cook. Sure, please.
Why in our formal liturgy do we have so many psalms?
Psalms?
I mean, I take your point on prayer.
Because they're lovely.
I take your point on prayer. But the actual form of the service seems to be surrounded by
right.
A tremendous amount of non-prayer.
Yes, the short answer to the question is that the Amidah is in a sense the central part, but you have to build up to it and let yourself down. It's like when you go for, as I'm sure you know, when you go to the gym, they tell you you've got to warm up and you've got to warm down, and that's the part that I don't. Warming up you can sort of convince yourself to do, but warming down is like, I mean, honestly, who does that? So that's why you see. So that's why you see that what happens. That towards the end of the davening, right, after our lateness, and no one stays for the warming down. It's like, it's filling off, you know, run out the door as soon as you can. Because warming down, everyone's already finished with that. But again, to the same, I think, again, the short answer is I think that's really the idea, that we're sort of building up and again, letting ourselves down from that. But again, if you look through the details of it, then you can find lots of ideas within the actual details of it. But broadly speaking, I think that's the concept. Okay, so I won't spend a lot of time on Rav Kook, but just and Rav Kook's writings generally. So maybe we'll do a little bit of background actually, because Rav Kook is a name that we often sort of throw around, but maybe worth just saying a word or two about Rav Kook himself. So Rav Kook, there are actually two Rav Kooks, father and son, but the one who's more well known as Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook, was a rabbi at the turn of the 20th century. Very pioneering religious Zionist rabbi, very extremely religious in many ways. Actually, sort of a lot of his writings are maybe things which we would struggle with today, actually. But certainly on the Zionist side, very, very Zionistic. And yet, he actually, the State of Israel didn't come into being until after his death. I believe he died in the 20s or 30s or so. His son was an early chief rabbi of Israel, I think, unless I'm mistaken. His son was an early chief rabbi of Israel and obviously continued his legacy on from there. But Rav Kook Sr., Avraham Yitzchak Kook, predated the state itself, and doesn't just talk about Zionism in the sort of establishment of the State of Israel, which he does as well, but he talks a lot about it being a part, when we talk about the concept of Reshit Tzmichat Geulatenu, sort of the beginning of a redemptive period. He's talking very much from a sort of Kabbalistic perspective of a change in history, you know, the sort of seeds of change and how we're sort of entering into a time which is sort of heading much more towards a very different era. And there's a lot of Kabbalistic ideas going into his writings. And one of them is where he talks about the idea of nevuah, and he doesn't quite term it. He does actually link it to this phrase of chacham adif mi navi, but he talks about sort of an age of prophecy, and then an age of what we might call Torah Shabbat al peh, of oral law, which again existed before. To go back to Robin's question, it did exist before, but certainly wasn't formalized in quite the way it was during the time of the Mishnah and the Talmud, and he gives a very, very fascinating sort of historic overview where he talks about the time of Nevuah being a time of palpable, draws a sort of a number of distinctions between those times. He talks about the time of Nevuah, and maybe this comes back to Leonie's question from before, talks about it being a time of palpable sort of feeling the Almighty within our midst, right? Within the feeling, the presence of God in everything that we do. And it's something which we don't really see in later generations. It's certainly difficult for us to see it. But even in the times of the Gemara, you don't get the sense. When you read through the stories of Tanakh, particularly Nach, I would say, post-Torah. But Nach itself, when you read through those stories, you feel like everybody, and it's not just, we refer to a few prophets, but it's very clear that many, many, many people at the time had a very, very strong emotional connection with all their senses to a spiritual world which has been dulled to an extent, you know, which is very difficult for us to connect to in quite the same way. And that idea of being a sort of a much more emotional connection, a much more sort of to have those visions in quite that same way, is something which was very much part of that time and did disappear a little bit. Or quite a lot, did disappear in the next phase of history and was replaced to an extent with a much more intellectual connection, with a much more sort of logical, and that's why we have things like the Gemara, where it sort of takes us time to figure out and we go through halachot and talking about, as we said before, details and trying to sort of connect to God, not through emotion in quite the same way, but through that sort of understanding and delving and trying to look at the details and look at the world and look at how we sort of piece the puzzle together in a very, very different way to the way that the Nevi'im saw the world. And what Rav Kook was trying to argue is beautifully where he talks about how Moshe actually combined both. That we talk about Moshe as being both Navi and Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher, right? And the Torah is the only book, right? Whereas you go through Nach, there are no halachot at all, right? Nach is all about visions, almost no halachot at all. And you go through the Mishnah and the Gemara, and there's no visions, and it's all about halachot. The Torah is the only book which sort of has both, right? Where we have dry details, and we have the laws, and the technicalities, etc. And we also have the beautiful visions as well. Certainly within the Book of Devarim, we have these wonderful statements, you know, that sort of are about ideals, and about Yirat Hashem, and Ahavat Hashem, and, you know, as you say, awe of God, and fear of God, and loving God, and all these sorts of things, combining, as we said, the vision and the particular, the sort of ideal and the particular, and what Rav Kook was talking about is in the sense that we're sort of heading back towards a time where we're sort of required to fuse the two. Now, he wasn't saying that we have Nevuah back in the full sense, right? We don't have prophets nowadays, but he was talking about the sort of, because one of the other differences that he noted actually is that when the prophets are talking, they're talking to who? They're talking to a nation. They're talking to a people. They're always talking in the plural, right, to many, many people. And when Chazal are talking, when you have a Mishnah, who is it talking to? He said it's almost always talking to individuals. Yes, there are certain laws that apply to communities and to larger groups, but it's almost always talking to us as an individual. What can I do from here? And what Rav Kook was trying to say was, in a sense, sort of the state of Israel, as it pre the state of Israel, but that sort of coming era is a time where we sort of have to be able to fuse both the individual and the general, both us as individuals and the community as well. That's very much just touching upon his ideas, and again something to look at further. But I'll just perhaps conclude by saying that, if any comments or questions before I wrap up. So I think that what Rabbi Sacks really brought out here was a very, very beautiful idea, one that I'd never struck me before, and one that I think we could spend a lot longer thinking about and finding proofs for, and sort of trying to figure out how it can plug into different areas of life. But I also think that actually, to my mind, this to an extent summed up Rabbi Sacks himself. Right, somebody who was able to have those beautiful visions to sort of paint a picture which would inspire and which would be lofty and which would sort of make us feel like we, like we're soaring above the world, and yet also to have very technical things, you know, to put into place things which made a difference to our society, to our small Jewish world, to the wider world, to sort of really have an impact. And I think, you know, if we go through his life and legacy, I think we see the ways in which he didn't just give vision, but actually gave practical impact to the world, and how, in a sense, the world is a different place as a result of that. And although we talk about Chacham Adif Minavi, this idea of sort of the wisdom being greater than the prophecy, I still think that it's important for us to be able to hopefully fuse both, to be able to have that sense of idealism, to be able to have that vision, to think about where it is we want to go, to have the statement on the wall, whether we listen to it or we don't. It's good that it's on the wall. It's good that we sort of have that there to remind us as a reminder, and yet also trying to put into place the little things that were the little steps that will hopefully get us there and that will take us along that path. Thank you very much.